They took the land away. Enclosure, it's called now. But theft would be an equally appropriate term. At one time in England, as in many places, most people made their living by farming the land around them. This land was called the Commons, and it was open, often held by families and groups who had by tradition or verbal agreement a place to make themselves a livelihood. I spent a lot of time at a Unitarian Universalist retreat center in North Carolina called The Mountain. And there I met a man who would teach about how in many slave communities, the slave owners had taken the drums away. And he would get very lively, and he would call in response. He would ask people to say, "They took the drums away." And so in his honor, I'd like to ask you to say with me, "They took the land away." They took the land away. The wealthy gentry found grazing sheep was quite profitable. So they took the land away. From the 13th century through the 19th century, Parliament passed laws, and they took the land away, forcing people out of house and home, replacing cottages and subsistence farming with fields of sheep. They took the land away. At one time, there was a belief that any English woman or man who could construct a roof over their heads and have a hearth in the fire between sunrise and sunset could live on that common land undisturbed. In 1588, English Parliament passed the Erection of Cottages Act to insist that this was not, in fact, the case. Yet, those with the means to build fences and force inhabitants off the land were often free to claim ownership simply by the act of enclosure. In the words of George Orwell, written in 1944, "Stop to consider how the so-called owners of the land got a hold of it. They simply seized it by force, afterwards hiring lawyers to provide them with title deeds. In the case of the enclosure of the common lands, which was going on from about 1600 to 1850, the land grabbers did not even have the excuse of being foreign conquerors. They were quite frankly taking the heritage of their own countrymen, upon no sort of pretext except that they had the power to do so." End quote. There's something about the topic of this sermon, which I've entitled "The Real Tragedy of the Commons," that can feel abstract, removed from the relevant issues of our present experience. Yet this message weighs on my heart and tells me that it does matter, and it matters now. So I've been asking myself, well, why do I care that those people lost the commons so long ago? And why should you care? What does all this have to do with you and me, right here, right now? And the answer comes, this story lives in our bones. The consequences of what happened then have shaped all the events leading up to now. I believe there was once an awareness among all peoples of the world that the land was alive and worthy of respect, not something that could be owned or divvied up. People who see the earth this way live very different lives from those who look upon the world as made up of objects, things without intelligence that are ripe for exploitation. Thich Nhat Hanh teaches the concept of interbeing, a deep level connection and interdependence that we share with the rest of the web of life. And so he says, we cannot truly be well while our neighbor is suffering. Though we may convince ourselves for a time that we are islands, able to live our lives insulated from others, we're just avoiding the truth. Islands are not truly separated from the other land masses of the world, but intimately connected to the earth, attached to the same moving, shifting earthen floor that we all share. Even the water and the air are not empty space, but vital living elements that are mediums of our connection. So what sort of well-being can we truly enjoy while the earth suffers? When the earth suffers, so do we. Of course, this is a truth relatively self-evident when we look at the impacts of climate change. On a deeper level, though, what if people suffering from chronic pain, from depression or anxiety, or from a whole host of ailments are in fact manifesting the pain of the earth in their bodies? The thing is, the story of losing the commons, it doesn't stop there. In the 1850s in the UK, will you say it with me? They took the land away. They took the land away. Even more than the land. They took the idea of the commons away. Or at least it was pushed to the fringes, left to activists who were marginalized and criminalized. And so when settlers arrived in the New World, they took the land away. The wealthy came looking for more land to own. The poor came looking to get wealthy. The descendants of the farmers who worked the commons were thrust into poverty, working in factories and living in English slums. Their dreams became not to regain the commons, but to get land of their own. And so when colonists encountered the Native Americans, they took the land away with swords, with guns, with germs, with new laws, false treaties, and broken promises. They took the land away. Let me read you an excerpt from the writings of Merrill E. Gates, written in 1885. Merrill was considered a humanitarian Indian reformer. He served as the president of the Board of the Indian Commissioners, and he was called, as recently as the 1970s, a friend of the Indians. He writes, "There can be no material advance in civilization unless landed property is held by groups at least as small as families. The tribal organization, with its tenure of land in common, with its constant division of goods and rations per capita, without regard to service rendered, cuts the nerve of all that manful effort which political economy teaches us proceeds from the desire for wealth." End quote. When the land is held in common, Merrill says, there can be no stimulus to industry. There can be no incentive so strong, he says, as the confidence that by long, untiring labor, a man may secure for himself a home and for his family. Well, I'm left to wonder, did the people holding the land in common not already have homes? Did they require untiring labor just to secure it? The message here is clear. There's only one acceptable, even possible way to live in this world. You can defer to power, follow the law, and work to become a property-owning citizen, or you can be a vagrant, subject to violence, poverty, and exploitation by those who have more power than you do. The Great Sioux Nation, for example, held 134 million acres as spelled out in the 1851 Treaty of Fort Laramie. Yet 6 years later, the United States broke that treaty when George Custer led an expedition into the area and confirmed reports of gold. And so the United States took that land illegally, reducing the nation from 134 million acres held in common to less than 15 million acres. And that's just one story of many. In every case, the tricks and techniques that were used to force people from common land into a system of private ownership, controllable by the state, was tried and perfected in England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales, and all sorts of other places before it ever came to America. My point is that our ancestors have all experienced this. Wherever we are from, on some level, we know in our blood, in our bones, what it was like to live together in community and relationship before it happened, before they took the land away. Let us sing together. About the tragedy of the commons. Our teacher explained to our class how a bunch of farmers in England each had incentive to gain as much personal profits as possible. They would try to put as many cattle or sheep as they could on the land before the others did the same. And due to self-interest, destroying the land was inevitable. Each person would overgraze and overuse the common resource. As I received the message, there was no way a commons could last. Humans are selfish, and they'll take all they can until there's nothing left. Well, this made me sad, learning about the tragedy of the commons, the inevitable result of human selfishness. I think a part of me knew, deep down, that something about this story just felt wrong. Is the only proper way to manage a society to divvy up everything into private property so that people have an incentive to keep it nice? As a child, I knew that resources were being depleted all over the earth. I accepted this story of tragedy as true because it seemed to fit the world I knew. Or did it? The summer after my junior year of high school, I went to the Mountain Retreat and Learning Center to take part in a 5-week program for UU youth. 11 of us lived in a cabin together, and they called us the Ascenders. Well, you know how UUs love acronyms? Well, this one, Ascender, stood for All Summer Campers Exploring Nature's Delights and Experiencing Recreation. What that acronym failed to mention was that we had to work. We were divided up into groups, and we served in the camp kitchen, in housekeeping, and in maintenance, rotating through the weeks so that each ascender tried all the positions. We were responsible for keeping our common space clean and tidy, divvying up chores, and we completed group service projects for the good of the entire mountain community. We worked hard. And we worked a lot. And most of the time, we loved it. Maybe this is my experience of the commons. We shared everything. We lived and worked together, guided by a covenant and community guidelines. Back at home, I was not a teenager known for completing my chores with enthusiasm and gusto. But here, in this community, I found I fell in love with the shared experience of living and working together. Looking back, it seems that work in my home environment came from a place of anxiety or fear. This is the anxiety of privatization. You can defer to power, follow the law, and work to become a property-owning citizen, or you can become a vagrant, subject to violence, exploitation, and poverty. Through suffering and constant toil, we have to stave off that frightening fate that threatens the lazy. Is this not the Protestant work ethic? As an ascender at the mountain, our desire to work came from a different place. We cared about one another, and we cared about the place that we shared together. Rather than the anxiety of privatization, that falsely manufactured scarcity, the fear of struggling to survive. At the mountain, we worked from a place of meaning-infused compassion. Unitarian Universalism teaches that each of us holds a piece of the truth, that we are better together, that our search for meaning is a communal endeavor. We say that we are all a part of the interdependent web, yet we are swimming in the waters of separation. We're now seeing the unfortunate results of individualism and the fear this ideology feeds on. Reading the news, it's hard to escape the feeling that we are on a sinking ship. The powerful take more and more and must spend more and more to secure it from those who have nothing. For me, it's not a question of greed. It's a question of fear. And what helped our current U.S. president get into the office more than fear? We've been facing challenging times even within our own denomination. At our General Assembly this summer, we were taking a hard look at how our own process contributes to perpetuating racial injustice and marginalization of those who are a minority among Unitarian Universalists, but members of the global majority. Racism was born in this country to protect the interests of wealthy plantation owners. How could racism have been established without slavery? How could slavery have been established without private property? The ideology that condones ownership of living earth and living beings. As a middle schooler learning about the tragedy of the commons, I felt some unnamed deep sadness. The suggestion that we are all inherently selfish, that we must harness our self-interest before it destroys us, is just inviting existential crisis. What could be more depressing? The good news is that we're learning just how wrong we've been. Indeed, the idea of the tragedy of the commons was criticized from the beginning. There are examples all over the world of commons that are well managed and utilized. Scientists and researchers are now finding that humans are not quite as selfish as Western thought once believed us to be. Indeed, it is our inherent ability to cooperate that has allowed us to survive. If our faith teaches us that we are all a part of the web of life, that we all have inherent worth and dignity, then what are we doing trying to own the land? Unitarian Universalism is a covenantal religion. And my friends, I believe it is time to awaken to our potential and spread the good news. To be a community of covenant, to be a community of joy, we must confront the story of separation. We must confront the fears of our ancestors, forced off some communal land and into a world of scarcity and competition. Unitarian Universalist minister Sue Phillips says that the practice of covenant, which has been with us since our beginning as a faith, is the missing key that we have dropped and left behind along the way. She shares her vision of covenanting as an ongoing, dynamic process that reaches far beyond the current use of covenant as a set of behavioral norms or an abstract ideal. This form of covenanting could become our polity, the very structure and doctrine that hold us together. She insists, in its richest expression, covenanting is a prophetic and tradition-tested way to reimagine and re-engage the ties that bind liberal religious people in a networked world. Most people today do not want to be placed in a silo, but to feel that their faith connects them to the larger world. When we feel at our most hopeless, when the problems that we face are so large, do we not look to our religious communities to help us find meaning? Do we not seek some clue from our fellow seekers as to how we might navigate these dark waters? Do we not wish to be, somehow, some way, a part of a movement that doesn't merely whack at the vines of inequity, but digs deep to the roots of injustice in order to work for a better world? I hope that I've said something today that's provoked thought or maybe that you've disagreed with. I certainly don't have all the answers here, but I'm asking you to meditate on this question. Where does our desire to own things come from? Where does this desire for wealth come from? Is it a desire for security? Is it a fear of being unsafe, of not having enough? As I close the sermon today, I want to be clear with my message. I'm not suggesting that everyone go out and abandon their land holdings. Selling your property to someone else won't change the system, but rather, start with your perception. How can you change the way that you see the more than human world upon which you depend? The world in which everything is held in common. Think of the air and the sunshine. Then move to action. How would you live differently if you truly internalized the truth that the land we live upon is alive and worthy of respect? I believe that our message of a covenantal faith can model a different way of living in the world. An older way, perhaps. It's time to change the story that tells us we are separate from one another. I believe our recent vote to become a sanctuary congregation does just that. It's time to return to the commons. And like the ascenders, reclaim a way of living and working that is based not in fear, but in a meaning-infused sense of connection and compassion for all of our relatives. Amen and blessed be.